Hello everyone, welcome to Hear the World. My name is Asaf Ofir, and I've been interviewing people from different faiths about their insights on the coronavirus. Today, I'm going to be speaking with Sheikh Fayaz Jaffer, who works as a chaplain at NYU. We're going to be talking about Islam.
Hi, Fayaz.
How are you, my friend?
Asaf, good. How are you? Nice to meet you.
Yes, likewise. How's it going?
It's going good.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for doing this. I really appreciate it. Thanks so much for making some time.
Absolutely.
You're out in New York?
I am out in New York, yes. I'm in New York City, Manhattan.
And you work as a chaplain at NYU?
I work as a chaplain at NYU. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So tell us, what exactly does it mean to be a sheikh?
Sheikh is a sort of symbolic term for someone who studied in the Islamic seminary. So it's, you know, likened to sort of a title for a faith leader, pastor, priest, rabbi.
Oh, cool.
So, you know, my primary, you know, role in education is really within the Islamic seminary. Though I serve as a chaplain at New York University, I also, you know, run a lot of prayer services, deliver sermons at local Islamic centers and mosques really across the country, across North America, really.
Yeah. Wow. And where were you from originally?
So I grew up here in Long Island, in New York. My family's ancestors go back to India, Gujarat. And my ancestors probably about close to 200 years ago migrated from India to East Africa, Kenya. My parents, grandparents, all born, raised in a small town, small region in Kenya, Mombasa, small island off of Kenya.
Cool.
Mombasa. So I was born over here in the States, here in New York, though,
right.
Long Island. Yeah.
Okay. And what made you choose to study Islam and become a sheikh? Like, what drew you to that?
I think I was really very curious when I was young, curious about everything. And I think, you know, asking questions about really basic things start to become a little bit more formulated, you know, sort of intellectually as you get older. So it's not, you know, limited to the, you know, basic questions of like, you know, why are there clouds up in the sky or why is the sky blue? But you start asking a little deeper questions like, what am I here for anyway? You know, where did I come from? Where am I going? What's my purpose? You know, who is God? Is there a God? All of these sorts of questions. And I think when I entered into that, I just didn't find like the answers that I was looking for. And I think in the midst of seeking, I realized that the only way I'm going to like really like find those answers if I'm really committed to, you know, to knowing the answers to those questions, I need to commit to them, you know, and committing to them. I think that, you know, religion, spirituality, kind of in whatever tradition you follow, you know, finding answers to those questions is like this lifelong journey. And I don't know what I would have done if I didn't have like religion, you know, in my life or spirituality as a path to, like, I don't know how people live without asking themselves those questions. And that's fine. You know, but I just know for myself, like I wouldn't have been able to live.
Sure.
Yeah. I hear that.
I'm curious if you can say something about how the virus is affecting you. I mean, right now you're out in New York. New York is kind of, the situation has improved a lot, hasn't it, over the last weeks?
Yeah, the situation has definitely improved over the last couple of weeks. But nonetheless, you know, I think that so many folks have been impacted locally here in New York City by it that we can't really get the bad taste out of our mouths, so to say. My mother-in-law passed away from COVID a couple of weeks back. So it hit sort of close to home. In addition to, you know, sort of in my role as clergy, you know, religious, you know, faith leader, the amount of like funerals or prayer services that I've attended, you know, for folks within the community, it has been so, you know, very, you know, overwhelming.
Wow.
To the extent that, you know, like when I, a couple of weeks ago, when we were really at the peak of it, maybe about, you know, a month or so ago, 6 weeks ago, like I couldn't sleep, you know, at night. Just I would be consistently thinking and like pondering like about death and, you know, not only my own mortality, but their families who have been inflicted, right? Not only in terms of death, but in terms of like the economic crisis, people lost their jobs and, you know, the poverty rampant that we see. And you know, you start really to see like classism and class structure and how it manifests in this society of ours, probably in a place like the Bay Area, you know, like where you're at, you start seeing like this disconnect, right? New York City is only for those who are wealthy.
You know, I think we're seeing it everywhere. Honestly.
Everywhere, yeah. And like, you know, this insistence on, making sure we're opening it up, right? Everything up, you know, to drive the economy back to where it belongs, but, you know, at the detriment of who? The detriment of working class people, detriment of, you know, minorities, right? In a lot of different regions in this country. So right. It's been tough, you know, but I think that what it does is sort of from like a religious lens is that it allows for people to sort of, you know, like reconnect, you know? Because we're seeing our mortality, you know, in front of us every single day. That, you know, puts things in perspective, so to say, not always in the most positive way, but nonetheless, I think that's just the reality of the situation that we're in at the moment.
Yeah. I wonder if, I don't know if you saw the questions I sent you. I think you saw them, that I like mm-hmm. to ask people if they had to describe their religion in three words. What three words would they choose? I don't know if you want to try to tackle that one.
Yeah. Journey, seeking, conviction. I don't know if they're in any particular order, but definitely, you know, those three words, you know, going back to, you know, spirituality, religion being something that is a journey that we're consistently seeking conviction for. You know, we go through ups and downs and hills and valleys, so to say, but, you know, I think we're working toward, you know, ultimate conviction. Conviction leads to contentment, leads to some sense of enlightenment, however you want to throw around those words. But definitely when you fall down, there's always an opportunity to get back up, to get back up. And that's why I, you know, really love the word, you know, journey, really love the word seeking, right? Because you're looking for something, you know, even when you think you found those answers, where did I come from? What's my purpose, right? There's a deeper answer to those questions. And they never stop. So you're consistently sort of unveiling, you know, and finding those realities and those truths. I mean, I think that, you know, a lot of people, they get really caught up in, you know, law and forms and jurisprudence and things like that, you know, not only, you know, within the Islamic context, but across, you know, really all the world religions. And, you know, they forget that, you know, the whole purpose of our existence, at least sort of within the Islamic context, is, you know, for us to find perfection, to reach perfection. You know, what is perfection? You know, when you think you've reached perfection, there's another, you know, layer of perfection that you have the potential to reach, meaning that, you know, it's never ending, you know, consistent sort of this long marathon of this journey for me to get closer to, you know, to God, for me to know myself, for me to know my creator. You know, and how that manifests externally in community, society, relationships, family, the work that we do collectively, individually, so on. You know, in the Arabic language, there's a famous term, you know, for someone who's seeking knowledge, they're called talib al-ilm. Literally, it means, a talib means a student, but talib also means a seeker, because knowledge is something that, you know, we never stop seeking, you know. Knowledge of ourselves, knowledge of our God, knowledge of nature, knowledge of all of these things, these are, you know, that's what knowledge is considered within the Islamic context. There's a whole sort of epistemology, you know, within, you know, amongst Muslim, you know, ethicists and philosophers, you know, what is knowledge? Is knowledge, you know, the information that I get in the news, or is knowledge, you know, and, they would argue that no, knowledge is the knowledge of oneself, the knowledge of God, the knowledge of seeing God's signs all around us, the sun, the moon, the stars, oceans, rivers, all of these sorts of things. And I think that, you know, recognizing it's a journey, consistently seeking on this path, you know, take us toward this, you know, ultimate conviction, right? Now I know, I believe, right? But again, that itself has different layers to it.
Right, yeah.
And then it just starts again, right? You start the journey again, you start seeking again, you get to another level of conviction. You know, I think that our intellects, our sort of spiritual capacity is so much greater than what we might think, you know, sort of on the most basic, you know, level. You know, my older daughter, she's 5 years old, for instance. She's just learning words, you know, in these really basic children's books, like I can see, I like to eat, you know, and she gets very frustrated with them. And then she like throws them on the floor and she says, she says, I don't know how to read. And then when she gets it the next time, she tries again. She says, oh my God, I know how to read everything.
Yeah.
Because she thought that she had peaked, you know? It happens to all of us, right? We think that, you know, there's no way I can get beyond this. And then when you get beyond, you're like, oh my God, you know, like the sky is the limit, so to say, until you fall down again, right?
Right.
You get back up and you're like, oh my God, you know? So I think that our spiritual capacity, our ability to be receptive, you know, our ability to know God, our ability to know our responsibility to ourselves, they don't have limits.
Mm.
And then when you're, you know, when you're in that mode of, you know, communicating with God, I just feel like there's nothing, no experience like it, so to say. It's something very, very beautiful.
Mm.
In a famous, you know, tradition, in a famous supplication of one of the, you know, he's the great grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, who's, you know, revered within the Islamic tradition, a man by the name of Ali Zain al-Abidin.
Mm.
He states, or it is attributed that he has said in a line of poetry virtually, إِلَهِ مَنْ بَلَّذِي ذَاقَ حَلَاوَةَ مَحَبَّتِكَ فَرَامَ مِنْكَ بَدَلًا. In the Arabic language, he states, oh God, who has tasted the sweetness of your love and found anything else?
Mm.
There's something beautiful about that. There's something beautiful about that moment in communication with God. Once you feel the presence of God, you're not concerned about anything else. You know, so the world and its distractions can't deceive you in that moment, for sure.
Right. Wow. Wow. Thanks for sharing that. Yeah, I wonder if you have, you know, kind of going to the virus and to what's going on right now. I mean, I don't know if things are more up in the air now, you know, like when it first started, or now when it seems like it's all coming back and there are cases surging. And I wonder, coming from your point of view, if there's any insights that you have to share, what do you think that Islamic wisdom might have to say about what the world is facing right now? Or, you know, tackle the question any way you want, but kind of, do you have anything to share from your point of view?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, this you know, last several months has been really, really trying and really difficult for so many people, for this country, you know, for our respective communities. Like I mentioned before, mortality and economic crisis and how it's impacted, you know, oftentimes the most vulnerable. Domestic violence sort of cases are like on the rise. I do a lot of work in that regard, and I see that, you know, every single day, because everyone is stuck at home. And again, sort of, you know, it's a trying period. There's a couple of, you know, Quranic verses that I sort of cling on to during times like this, or, you know, not to sound cliche or anything, but the verse states, you know, after every difficulty, or with every difficulty, there is ease. Surely with every difficulty, there is ease. That, you know, part and parcel of life is to go through, you know, trials and tribulations, to go through the downs as much as we go through the ups. And that's not something, you know, that we want to say, you know, a very dogmatic way when someone is going through hardship. Someone comes to me and says, I'm going through financial difficulty. And I say, no, you know, this is life. You have to go through difficulties. No, not in that way, but in a way whereby we see things, you know, from like a bird's eye view. And we may not have all the wisdoms necessarily to, you know, isolate a particular instance within our history and say that, you know, this was a difficulty and it wasn't that big of a deal, because in the moment, it's a very big deal, you know? You know, maybe 10 years from now, we won't think it's a big deal, but right now it is, right? And it's impacting us, and it's hurting us, and we're struggling with it, right? But, you know, like I said before, you know, I think that there's also an opportunity for us to, you know, rethink things.
Mm.
As difficult and as much hardship, you know, that so many local communities, how many, you know, so many in this country, so many across the world, and have had to undergo during the course of, you know, these last several months, it puts a lot into perspective. It's been a humbling experience, you know, the fact that folks are at home, you start to live with yourself a little bit more.
Mm.
And when you live with yourself, either you can go crazy or you can realize a lot of things about yourself and you can improve them. You can see growth even in difficulties and in hardships, is what I'm trying to say, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And when I go back to those verses of the Quran, like I said, oftentimes they get thrown around very dogmatically in order to tell someone, be patient in the midst of the hardship, as opposed to say, growing out of hardship is actually the objective of going through any trial or tribulation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think cultivation of this growth, cultivation of something more positive beyond, you know, what we're seeing, you know, and the difficulty that we're enduring, is the most important sort of, you know, outcome of what we have the potential or the possibility to attain, if that makes sense. So in other words, when someone, you know, loses their job, when someone has a death in their family, are they going to learn from that experience in order to become a better person out of it? Mm. That doesn't mean you can't grieve. That doesn't mean you can't go through, you know, depressions and anxieties and stresses. No, that's fine. That's natural. It's what it means to be a human being.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we're not, you know, within the Islamic context, we don't believe that we've been created for this world. We're created for something greater. We're created for something bigger. In this world, you make an impact, but we don't believe that this is the be-all, end-all. We believe, you know, in a world beyond this one. And it starts with leaving behind as great of an impact that I can in my 50, 60, 70, 80, you know, 100 years, you know, in this corporeal existence. And in a time of difficulty, if I have not been victimized in the same way that so many others have, what am I doing? What am I doing individually to giving back to people, right, who are going through those hardships? So if you've not been impacted, if I've not been impacted, you know, directly by COVID, for instance, I've not had deaths in my family. I've not, you know, struggled financially during all of this, right? Maybe even the opposite. You have an opportunity to come to the service of others. Not you, but you know what I'm saying, you know, collectively as, an, you know, as a people. So I think that it kind of twofold. Those who have gone through hardships and difficulties is an opportunity for growth. Those who, you know, have not necessarily been impacted in the same way, what can you do to give that? Also growth, right? So in the midst of everything that we're enduring, there's also some cultivation that can occur. There's some beauty that can come out of it, you know, so to say. But that requires a little bit of reflection and pondering and contemplation and meditation, you know? It's not something that, you know, you go, the first thing you think about is, okay, how am I going to grow out of this, right? No, you need to kind of sit on it for a little bit. So I think that, you know, what I think that the Islamic tradition really emphasizes is in moments that are unique, in moments of difficulty, in moments of trials and tribulations, to be introspective for a bit, to sort of reflect on, you know, everything that I'm undergoing, and then see how I can, you know, how can I grow? How can I cultivate? How can I be receptive to what I'm going through and allow for the outcome to be that much more positive? I'm not sure if I'm being clear.
Yeah, no, being very clear. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, thanks a lot. There are things that I'm very drawn to ask you, especially coming from my own point of view, because I grew up in Israel. And I had some, you know, I had Muslim friends, especially in college, but I don't know much about Islam. I really honestly don't. And I think there are a lot of people out there that don't know much about Islam. And I think there's also a lot of fear around Islam, especially for people who don't know much about it. And the first thing I'm curious about is, have you felt that, you know, that lack of knowledge or that fear affect you in your own life? Has it reached you? Do you encounter it in your own life?
Yeah, I think so. Absolutely. I was in the ninth grade during 9/11. So first year of high school, kids in the ninth grade are kind of mean, as you can imagine. So I think, you know, definitely if I reflect back on, you know, in my life and sort of my youth, I was definitely bullied, you know, for being Muslim because of a lack of knowledge of really what, you know, because people, you know, they attributed, you know, terrorism to Islam when, you know, we see that there are a whole host and variety of different manifestations of terrorism and extremism and violence. You know, I think, you know, in the work that I do, serve as a chaplain at, you know, New York University's Islamic Center, and sort of in the, you know, political environment that we're living in, specifically, you know, post-2016, the number of hate crimes, you know, targeting Muslims is at an all-time high in New York City, even, you know, in a place as sort of, you know, liberal and progressive, and I put that in quotes, you know, as you can find in this country, there is still, you know, a lot of bigotry and xenophobia. So certainly I think that there's a lack of knowledge, you know, about Islam, about Muslims, about the religious traditions and practices and so on. And I think that a lot of this is sort of like fed, you know, via the bombardment of, you know, like mass, you know, media and pop culture.
Yeah.
Right. You know, you turn on the TV and you see some, you know, guy who looks like me, right, performing the Muslim prayer. And then, like, you know, 45 seconds later, he's like, you know, trying to blow up New York City or something like that, you know? And it's like, you know, you wonder kind of like where that came from. You know, it's just sort of like this popularization of, you know, really isolating, you know, minority faces, right, in this country. You know, as much as I'm been a victim of, you know, hate crimes myself, as much as I've heard, you know, every single possible word of, you know, insult, you know, for being a Muslim, for looking the way that I do, I still don't know like what it means to be a black man, you know, in America, because their experience is that much, you know, that much more worse, I can imagine. Again, like, where does that come from? Again, other than this sort of colonialist, you know, mentality and this sort of, you know, picture that is drawn like on the media, you know, of, you know, of the criminalization of black people, you know, and we see in the remnants of that today with, you know, police protests and, you know, the you know, everything that's taking place, across the country. And so I think that, you know, there are plenty of resources today that are available for people who want to know and learn about, you know, the religion of Islam. There is nothing to be, you know, scared about. So, you know, I would really recommend folks to go out and take a look, you know, at, you know, resources that are available, you know, locally, you know, within their own cities, within their own communities. Our center, the Islamic Center at New York University, you can reach out to myself directly, and go on our website and, you know, learn a little bit about, you know, the small community that we serve over here in New York City, Muslim community. And so, you know, definitely there are opportunities to learn, but certainly I can also see why people might be, you know, fearful of that. And I think that where we have an opportunity to sort of shift the narrative collectively as a community, you know, we have that responsibility.
Thanks.
Yeah. I mean, I would just very briefly maybe say that, you know, when we talk about the religion of Islam, I think that it is something very misunderstood. Oftentimes people only see Islam through like a geopolitical lens as well. And they see, you know, sort of one dimension of it. That's not really Islam. Islam is a religion. It's a theology. It's a jurisprudence. It's a spiritual school. And I think that when you divorce these three realities, the belief system, theology, the law and jurisprudence, and sort of the ethics and spirituality out of any religious tradition, and you only see it through the frame of geopolitics, or you only see it through the frame of, you know, what media is showing or whatever it is, you're missing out like on a really incredible like tradition. And I'm talking about not only Islam, but all religious traditions across the board in this regard. You know, we're talking about a tradition that is 1400 years old. We're talking about a religious tradition that is practiced by close to 1.75 billion people, you know, across the world. We're talking almost 25%, you know, 1/4 of the population of the world by 2050, you know, as models predict. So we're not talking about like a fringe movement, right? We're talking about something that is like attractive to people.
Yeah.
People are attracted to something within it, right? It's definitely not what is showing up on the media, you know?
Right.
So if for people to be open to different things and to experiencing different things and to, you know, exposing ourselves to, you know, what other people believe, I think is just a good practice in general, you know? And maybe, again, I'm speaking sort of my nerdy capacity as, you know, someone who's interested in theology and in religion and so on. But definitely, I think, you know, folks should, again, feel free to reach out if they have any questions. I'm happy to sort of be helpful, you know, in the best of my capacity.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. I guess I have one last personal question, again, if you want to tackle it. It's something that has fascinated me as a person who's, you know, maybe like you, kind of very fascinated by different points of view, different religions, different theologies. And I've always wanted to, you know, I grew up you know, next door to another nation that is predominantly Muslim, and there's a lot of tension between the two nations. And I've always wanted to go to a Muslim, and I've tried this with a few friends, and just say, what to you is the beauty of Islam? And I'll tell you what I mean in Judaism. There's certain things that, you know, like you say, you don't see them in the media, and you don't see them in even in the Holy Scriptures. You see them when you walk into someone's home, and you see the candles burning, and you smell the bread cooking, and you see the family and the love that they have for each other, and you know, you sit down to dinner and you hear the jokes, and there's a certain beauty, you know, there's a certain beauty. And I wonder if there's anything, like if I were to ask you, show me the beauty of Islam, what image comes to your mind?
That's a beautiful question, first of all. And a beautiful explanation on, you know, within your respective tradition.
Thanks.
The first thought when you were speaking that came to my mind was community. Islam emphasizes a great deal communal prayer, communal pilgrimage to Mecca, you know, through the Hajj pilgrimage, communal breaking of fast during the month of Ramadan, being with people. It's seen as an act of worship when you are with others and you're communicating with them and you're just spending time with them, like you mentioned. There is some beauty that comes out of that to create a link of hearts between, you know, believers, between brothers and sisters, you know, within Islamic, you know, sort of cultural custom. When you address another Muslim man, you would say brother. When you address a, you know, Muslim woman, you would say sister. So there's a custom of seeing ourselves as one large family, one large nation, one large people. And I think that, you know, when you see that manifest during the Hajj pilgrimage, during, you know, performing of congregational prayers, Muslims pray five times a day, performing that as prayers, and congregations are very, very encouraged. The Hajj pilgrimage, breaking fast during the month of Ramadan, or even just sharing a meal with one another. There's so much emphasis on that. And someone would say, I don't get why. How does that take you closer to God? How does it take you closer to knowing yourself? And I would argue that it does, right? When you are spending time with other people, you learn more about yourself. You learn more about others. God did not create this world solely that we worship and obey, you know, and pray, you know, and supplicate, you know, in our own homes. Yes, there's a time for that. But also, you know, we are a creation and we are a creature that needs to be with people, that needs to communicate, that needs to sort of be social in some way. And the encouragement of that, as long as, you know, it's taking us closer toward those goals, you know, as you see it manifest within Muslim community, is very, very beautiful. So I would say that, you know, come and, you know, go and visit your local mosque or reach out to someone and, you know, let them, you know, go and see what that's like, of course, when centers start opening up again.
Wear a mask. Yeah.
But and please wear a mask.
Whatever. Right. Do what you have to do. But yes. Yes. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, Fayaz Jaffer, thank you so very much for being a part of this.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So, thank you so much to Sheikh Fayaz Jaffer, the Muslim chaplain at NYU. And as always, I'd like to finish off with a little bit of music. And I have a good friend, Sirvan Manhubi, who just recorded this especially all the way down from Denver, Colorado, and he plays the oud. This is a Kurdish song called Gol Nishan. Thank you. Sir Van Manhubi playing the oud. The song was called Gol Nishan. It's a Kurdish song. And I want to say again thank you to Sheikh Fayez Jaffer and to everyone for listening. This was Hear the World. My name is Asaf Ofir. Wishing everyone good health and all the best. Bye.